Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Kia ora. Welcome to Conversations with Wahine, brought to you by the Wellington branch of the National Council of Women, New Zealand.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with Wahine. I'm Sophie and I'm here today with Ash. How are you today, Ash?
Good. A little hungry, so ignore my stomach if you hear it rumbling during this.
And today we're very lucky to be joined by Philippa Yazbek. Philippa Yazbek is an economist with a background in public policy and a career in the public service. She has authored reports for the Helen Clark Foundation on political transparency and rethinking the approach to methamphetamine regulation. Philippa also has an interest in public health and has co-founded Gun Control NZ. She is the deputy chair of the Ministerial Arms Advisory Group and a member of the Advisory Committee for Global Action on Gun Violence. Philippa is also a former board member of the Holocaust Centre of New Zealand. Wow, Philippa.
What a CV.
What a CV. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
It's absolutely fantastic to have you here. I've been very excited because I've had you booked for so long, since October last year. Such a broad variety of things that you've across. So you're a member of the Ministerial Arms Advisory Group and a member of the Advisory Committee for Global Action on Gun Violence and founder of Gun Control NZ. Can you tell us a little bit more about what led you to these groups, to be involved in these groups?
Sure. I was not somebody who thought very much about guns generally. My father had guns and actually at home in the safe, and my brother uses guns, but it wasn't really something I was particularly interested in. I tried shooting them once or twice when I was younger, but not really something that floated my boat. But I think, like many people, on the 15th of March 2019, I was kind of sitting on the couch in absolute shock at what had happened. And I think also, like many people, I had assumed that New Zealand's gun laws were very similar to Australia. And I was shocked to discover that the terrorist was able to really easily access firearms. And I was kind of wanting to do something, thinking about various things. And my first instinct was to donate some money to a gun control advocacy group. But I discovered that there weren't any in New Zealand. There had been one in the 90s. Some people may remember Philip Alpers of Fair Go. He had one that's probably a reference only for people sort of 50 and over. I didn't live in New Zealand in that era. So he had started one in the 90s in the wake of the Aramoana massacre. But he received a lot of harassment, hate, abuse. He'd have parcels show up in the mail with bullets and feces and dead animals and all sorts of things. So he quit and moved to Australia. And it kind of, the group sort of fell apart after that. So I have some friends who work in the public health space and was talking to them about this. Another friend of mine started a petition against semi-automatic firearms, which I think got about 50,000 signatures. And we were kind of talking it over and thinking that the reason we were in this situation was that the gun lobby had always been very strong in New Zealand. They had always advocated for, you know, making sure there were as few restrictions as possible in firearms ownership. And they had really successfully blocked all attempts to limit access to semi-automatic firearms. There'd been the Thorpe Report back in the 90s, lots and lots of different attempts by Parliament to tighten things up, and they'd all failed. And part of that was because there wasn't a strong civil society voice advocating for gun control. Up till then, the only people who'd really had it on their radar were the police association and, you know, All Credit the Police Association, but they don't really speak for a large number of New Zealanders. And so we decided that if we didn't start it, kind of nobody would. And so we got involved. We were lucky to work with some researchers at the University of Otago who'd been doing things on firearms. Both of them have now retired. It sort of went from knowing almost nothing about the subject to, I guess, being something of an expert now.
Wow. I mean, yeah, like it's just come from, I think, I mean, obviously that, you know, that awful event triggered so much for so many people. And I guess in that time span, how long's that time span now? That's
so, 6 years.
Yeah.
This March.
Yeah.
We're coming up the anniversary in 2 weeks' time.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested, given the previous lobbyist in this space got so much hate, did that not make you nervous to go down this road?
We were quite nervous, but I think we felt like things had potentially changed in the way people approach things. We were very, very explicit when we started that if we received any kind of threats or anything that was illegal, we would be reporting those to police. And police, we had some conversation with police and they were very supportive and said, look, you guys, you know, are doing some important work and, you know, absolutely we'll be taking threats seriously because, you know, the people sending the threats would be people with access to firearms and therefore the risk is much higher. And we also were very clear that, you know, if license holders are as law-abiding and as responsible as they claim to be, they're not the sort of people who should be making threats against us. And so we certainly, you know, our Facebook page, you know, was a morass of kind of argumentative comments. We did a certain amount of blocking in the beginning. But people kind of got a lot of their frustration and anger out on their keyboards. We now don't allow comments on our Facebook posts. But when we did, before Facebook kind of allowed you to kind of block them completely, I think in all that time, I saw one thing that looked like a death threat and followed. It wasn't addressed to me. It was to someone else. And I followed that up with police. They acted immediately, got in touch with the person, spoke to them. The person themselves was kind of surprised that anyone was reading the comments and acknowledged that they had gone too far and were quite apologetic to the police officer. And I think there weren't any further issues after that. We've luckily, touch wood, not had any issues in the real world, you know, offline. And I think it's gone much better than any of us expected. But we were kind of prepared for potential trouble in that sense. Certainly did a lot of things like locking access to our personal social media profiles, so you can't just kind of find them and follow us and start messaging us. And we occasionally have the scarier thing has been when I do television interviews, there is an individual who I don't think has a firearms license, but he has stalking convictions, and he always emails our sort of generic email address trying to get in touch with me. And this is probably not terribly feminist, but I always respond using the name of the male co-founder in our group, saying, sorry, you know, we don't give these out. And he usually backs off. But yeah, I mean, that's more just about being a woman in public rather than anything specific about the gun control advocacy. But yes, there certainly are some interesting people out there in this world.
Yeah, I mean, it's whatever you've got to do to stay safe. You know, absolutely. So obviously all of these groups, they've come together from a gap, basically. You noticed a gap that we didn't have any gun control advocacy group to put to lobby and put pressure. And obviously it's been triggered from the Christchurch event. And so what about, how has it evolved now, and kind of what's Gun Control NZ's position now? Do you think we need to radically change our attitude and approach to gun regulation in New Zealand? And if so, you know, what changes would you want to see?
So the model is probably Australia, where they've been very, very successful in stopping mass shootings with their laws. It's quite difficult to access firearms in Australia. And the changes that were introduced in 2019-2020 were modelled on the Australian law. Our controls, however, are nowhere near as strict as Australia, so we still have some differences. So in Australia, collectors of banned semi-automatic firearms have to permanently disable them. Here, they just have to take out a vital part, like the firing pins, and store them at a different address. So those firearms could still be reassembled into fully functional semi-automatic firearms. So there are still a few risks and loopholes in our law that we would like to see tightened up, but broadly we have the right things in place. We have the ban on semi-automatic firearms, we have a gun registry in place, the licensing processes have been tightened up, we have safe storage requirements. So broadly we're in the right space. The thing that we are very concerned about at the moment is that Nicole McKee is the current minister in charge of firearms policy. She's the Associate Minister of Justice. And she used to be a lobbyist for COLFO, the Council of Licensed Firearms Owners. So all through 2019 and 2020, she was opposing all of the law changes that were being made, using arguments about it being too soon, that this isn't the way to do things. It was sort of all the kinds of lines you hear from the NRA and the US were the things she was saying. She didn't say thoughts and prayers.
Like,
but
how can you stand in front of the family of 50 victims and say it's too soon? I just don't understand how you can do that.
What's the rhetoric? What does too soon even mean?
I think, you know, she was complaining that, you know, they hadn't sufficiently consulted gun owners, that it was all happening far too fast, that people were being emotional and irrational about this, and the problem wasn't the guns, you know, guns don't kill people kill people, those kinds of things. But I think at the end of the day, she's just somebody who really, really likes her guns and doesn't want anyone interfering with that access. And yeah, and she's kind of ridden that wave all the way into Parliament and into the ministerial role through the kind of random chance of the way coalition politics happen. So there's just been a big consultation process on the Arms Act that there weren't any specific proposals for change. It was just a very generic, this is the Arms Act, this is how it works, what do you think? So we haven't actually really seen kind of the colour of her money. She's talked before the election, she talked about changes she would like to see. But since the election, she hasn't talked about that at all. But she used to talk about having a graded licensing system where license holders who passed kind of extra reference checks and that kind of thing would be allowed access to semi-automatic firearms to shoot them on ranges. And I am guessing that she will probably make those kinds of proposals. But whether she'll get them through cabinet or not is another question. I mean, if she were in charge, she would absolutely be widening access. But I think that's really dangerous. We only need to look at Sweden to see what happened there. Yeah. So back in 2023, which is only 2 years ago, under pressure from the hunting lobby, they widened access to semi-automatic firearms such as AR-15s. And then a license holder who legitimately had one of those firearms used it and murdered 10 people in a mass shooting. And now they're going to tighten up access again. And I think the Swedes, like us, were quite arrogant, you know, sort of had the view that this kind of thing isn't going to happen here. We're different. We're special. We're far more responsible than those, you know, silly Americans or, you know, whatever, and that kind of that sense of exceptionalism and it's not going to happen here is actually quite dangerous. And yeah, so I feel like the Swedes ran the experiment 2 years ago, and I certainly don't want to see us running the experiment here.
There's just no justification for an AR-15. You just don't need it. And, you know, when hunters are like, oh, for hunting, like, you don't need a semi-automatic weapon to hunt anything.
There are some very specialised pest control applications in New Zealand. So if you need to kill large numbers of deer in the high country or something, and they're shooting them out of helicopters, in those situations you do need them. And there are about 400 people in the country who are licensed to do that kind of pest control, and that's okay, but really nobody else needs them.
I know when I first moved here, I found it jaw-dropping the first time I drove past Gun City. I couldn't believe that was a thing here. You know, in Ireland, like, my brother has a gun, but it's very much a hunting rifle, that's it. And you have to be registered to a hunting club, you know, Garda vetted, all of that. And yeah, just the fact you can go into a gun store blew my mind. Like you said, I very much thought it was an Americanized crime, I suppose.
Yeah, and Gun City certainly has been kind of pushing the boundaries. The family that owns it are very pro-gun rights, and they kind of use gun rights type of language. And they've been very kind of in your face about their advertising and their signage and their promotional things. There are lots of other firearms retailers in New Zealand, but they're nowhere near as visible as Gun City, and I think they've been quite antagonistic. But you know, if you sort of go look at David Tipple, who owns it, he's got quite a bad rap sheet. He actually has managed to be convicted of firearms offences in the US
for
firearms trafficking, which is kind of amazing given how relaxed the Americans are about firearms issues. I know he has, there was an incident where he lives on a lifestyle block, and there was an incident where one or two people came to try and, I think, steal something, and they were fleeing and he shot them in the back. He's got a quite a long rap sheet, and I'm not entirely sure that it's fit and proper to have a firearms license, but yeah, that's a family-owned business, and they're just kind of multiple tipples out there who run the different branches. But yeah, there have certainly been issues with the way that they advertise and the signage around their stores, and particularly around Christchurch. I think it's been quite upsetting to the local community there.
I'm really interested if the rhetoric in the online space has impacted the interest in guns here. So I know, you know, with the kind of rise of the far right and white supremacy in the US, we started to see, because I work in the online safety space, we started to see the trickle down into here, where people are demanding, you know, the freedom of speech and having to explain that that's a US, in the US Constitution, it's not here. But we're definitely seeing that, you know, overflow from the internet of US beliefs and politics into the New Zealand space. And I've just wondered over the last few years, especially with Trump coming back into power, do you see that being influenced with, I guess, maybe a more vocal pro-guns rhetoric here?
So I think there's always been a lot of networking between the New Zealand gun lobby and the American NRA. So if you pre-2019, if you find the old Colfo newsletters, you can see them talking about their meetings with the NRA, and a lot of the language crosses over. What we saw post-2019 was certainly, you'd see, you know, non-New Zealanders weighing into the debates, but clearly didn't know anything about them. But you would certainly see New Zealanders using lines and rhetoric that comes from the US. So you'd have people talking about their Second Amendment right to bear arms, which obviously is not a thing in New Zealand, but people would be using that language. And there's certainly kind of that influence. A lot of the sort of slang and rhetoric comes from the US, and various sort of conspiracy theories. So I'm Jewish, but when we started it, I was not publicly Jewish. You couldn't Google me and figure that out. My surname is not Jewish. But we would get these sort of conspiracy theories about how we were funded by George Soros, which is sort of this gigantic anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. So we'd certainly see those kinds of things. I occasionally see firearms users with like some quite serious white supremacy symbols and that in their profiles. I always report those through to police and the SIS when I see those. I've also seen there's sort of a group of kind of white supremacist adjacent people down in Christchurch who've one of them was convicted of trying to of some sort of attempt to an attack on the mosque, but someone else associated with that group was posting in gun forums about wanting to build community and go shooting with people. And we've also seen quite a lot of sovereign citizen stuff come in. So the police did a big exercise to try and map out who was using sovereign citizen rhetoric in New Zealand, because it's quite a risk to police staff, you know, when they engage with people. Most of them are harmless, but certainly in other countries there have been sovereign citizens who have committed acts of violence against government employees. And so they've been sort of mapping them out in a big intelligence exercise. And they have definitely found quite a few of them have firearms licenses. So I think across the population, about 5% of people have a firearms license. But if you took the population of sovereign citizens, about 10% of them had firearms licenses. So there's definitely a bit of a skewing towards those kinds of sort of far right extremist views in unfortunately in the license holder population.
Yeah, I guess that it's really exposed you to, a part of society that, I mean, like you mentioned that your brother and your dad might have had a gun, but I really know very, very little about it. I mean, especially from the UK, I don't know anyone who owns a gun. And when I was in the US for the first time, someone did have a gun and I was terrified and I didn't really want to go into the house. So to me, it's such a foreign culture. And in terms of, so just for somebody who knows nothing about, you know, lobby groups, in terms of what, you know, Gun Control NZ do and the arms advisory group that you're on, and the other advisory committee for global action on gun violence, what does that actually involve? What does it look like?
Sorry, I just want to pick up on one of the things you said before I answer that question, and that is you almost certainly do know people in New Zealand who have firearms licenses. They just won't tell you. So I hear this from people because they know what I do, and so they tell me about the fact that they have a firearms licenses. But there are lots and lots of people, and they're predominantly men. More than 90% of license holders are men, but they're across all walks of life, and it is 5% of the adult population. So you almost certainly know some, but they probably have just never told you that they actually have a license. But you will know some. If you know 100 New Zealand men, I can guarantee you at least one of those will have a license. So they are around, but it's not generally a key part of their identity. And certainly what we've found is that the most vocal ones are the ones who are most closely allied with the gun lobby, the ones who don't... generally don't go shooting at a club, who hunt. They normally use firearms kind of on their own or with someone in their family. And those people are generally supportive of the changes that we've made. So for the most part, the license holding community does support the changes that have been made. It's just a very vocal minority, maybe 10, 20% of license holders who are actually kind of out there with the kind of more extreme views. But sorry, getting back to your question. So part of the reason I started Gun Control NZ was because I had worked in the public sector and kind of understood how the system worked and how to make change. And I wanted to use that knowledge to do something good. So it sort of depends what's on. Gun Control NZ work, it's often quite reactive. We do quite a lot of media work. So we will have people journalists writing to us asking for commentary on various issues that come up. We also try to get around and meet MPs and talk to them about these issues. So at the moment we have a few meetings coming up. We do that fairly regularly. We also respond, obviously, whenever there's any kind of consultation process, doing submissions. National Council of Women, I know, like these sort of like uber submission writers, I think. I mean, they used to be this joke in government that it didn't matter what the bill was, Business New Zealand or the National Council of Women would write a submission on it. We only really concentrate on things happening around the Arms Act. And, you know, kind of building relationships with people in the regulator, other civil society groups that are interested in this issue, trying to network, working with our members, keeping in touch with them. There's probably more stuff that we should be doing, but we are a voluntary organisation. Mm-hmm. Ministerial Arms Advisory Group is an advisory group to the minister. We meet once a month. Every second month in person, and that's sort of a much more formal process. We have an agenda, we have issues the minister's asked us to give feedback on. We have been through multiple ministers, probably five or six as the portfolio keeps moving around. But I can't really... that it's an interesting group because it does include people from all over the spectrum, from gun owners to non-gun owners, and from across the country. And, you know, there's someone from the Islamic Women's Council, Māori, non-Māori, like, you name it, the diversity is there. But and it's an interesting group and we have some really great conversations, but I can't really talk about it because it is for the minister. Global Action on Gun Violence, we haven't done very much on that one. The organisation is quite interesting because it's primarily an American group that is trying to challenge US gun laws by having other countries, other states sue the United States. So at the moment they've got a whole lot of litigation on behalf of the government of Mexico because Mexico has quite strict gun control laws, but with the sort of flow of drugs north, there's a flow of guns south that has been very destabilizing in Mexico. And they're suing the US government, arguing that the producers have been irresponsible in allowing their firearms to be trafficked. And so in the US is kind of a shield for the gun industry that means people can't sue them. We have this perception of America being a very litigious society, but Congress passed these laws years ago that protect them from the manufacturers and retailers from any kind of consumer liability. But they're sort of trying to get around these laws by talking about the effects of the firearms outside of the United States. They've got a case coming up with the US Supreme Court, I think, in the next few months. So that will be quite interesting. But it's sort of a long program of litigation. So not really my specialist topic. But, yeah, they have put together a network of people with an interest around the world on gun control issues.
Wow, that's amazing. So you've yet to attend one of these?
So the group, so Global Action on Gun Violence is a relatively new group and they're sort of concentrating on these cases at the moment. So we haven't really, I mean, obviously the people who aren't, you know, the sort of Mexican experts have been engaged quite a lot, but we're yet to sort of start thinking about other potential avenues for more creative litigation in other parts of the world.
It's so good to hear that New Zealand has a foot in and hopefully a voice in the international community on gun control,
you know,
to support countries, you know, like Mexico. Because I had no idea that Mexico had such stringent gun regulations, you know, and the reason why you don't know that is because clearly it isn't supported by as much as we'd like by the US.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's That's really cool. That's really interesting work.
I'm also really interested in 3D printing and whether that's something that you come across, because I know in our space we definitely see more and more manuals and particularly being shared about, you know, instruction manuals on how to 3D print guns.
Yeah.
Is that something you are involved in at all?
I have seen some of the manuals, and I have to say some of them are kind of terrifying because
Absolutely.
They give instructions not only on how to 3D print but also on how to like cover your tracks and not be caught by officials, and the things you ought to do, you know, to maintain what they call operational security. So yes, it is an issue, and the police are finding more 3D printed firearms. I think the review of legislation is actually an opportunity to tighten up on this area. So in some jurisdictions, they ban the possession or sharing of the actual 3D printing files and the information about how to manufacture firearms, which I think is quite an important control. It's obviously not something that is going to be perfect, but there are a few measures that we can take. There's also generally it's very difficult to print a 3D firearm, print 100% of it, and make a firearm that can fire kind of more than once or twice. And they're often importing various kinds of metal components such as the barrels. So we also need to have tighter controls on those imports and make sure that customs are picking them up at the border and that kind of thing. So I think there are certainly things that we can do, but yes, it is a rising threat, and it is motivated by some very extreme ideologies as well. And I think, you know, and this is kind of the issue that I'm not sure is quite appreciated by the people who want to undo all of the controls that we have, is that there's sort of this rising threat environment in the background. If you look at somewhere like the US, those mass shootings are increasing all the time. Every year there are more mass shootings than the year before. And, you know, we're not immune from that. You do see the same rhetoric here. There have been foiled school shooting plots in New Zealand. So the risks are increasing. And the more forms of access there are to firearms, the greater the risk that something actually goes wrong and we have another tragedy.
Because to me, that's such a niche drive, you know. Like, what I mean, you talk about the 5%, the quite extremist 5% of, of pro gun lobbyists, but like, I can't ever imagine a situation where you would want to, create 3D print your own firearm.
Well, the people who want to 3D print are not the people who are able to buy them from the shop. And I think they're two groups. There are people who are just kind of tinkerers and curious about what they do, who like making things and are just like, this looks kind of interesting, can I do it? And that group is not, not particularly dangerous on the surface of it. But the more worrying group are sort of the criminal groups or the people who don't have licenses but who want to access firearms, who are then 3D printing them because it's an easy way to access firearms, and particularly as it becomes harder to get a hold of firearms as the registry really starts to bite, criminal groups will be looking at other avenues to access firearms. That will be through thefts, potentially trying to get them over the border, which is quite hard, or 3D printing is. And kind of, police always are picking up kind of homemade firearms and things that people have made themselves, and they're often incredibly dangerous. But yeah, 3D printing is certainly a growing threat.
Wow, I really had no idea. Thank goodness we have you, Philip. I had honestly no clue. New Zealand has, an extraordinarily high rate of violence against women, with one in three women being subjected to physical or psychological violence by an intimate partner over the course of their lifetime. This is a pretty well-known thing in New Zealand. So the proportion of cases where firearms are used is very small, but it is substantial in New Zealand. Almost one-fifth of homicide cases in which a man has killed a woman involved a firearm. So Do you think better gun control needs to be implemented in order for us to see a more gender equal society?
Absolutely. I mean, the very issue of firearms, I think, is a gendered one, given the patterns of usage, you know, the fact that more than 90% of the users are men. And New Zealand, I think, has been better than many jurisdictions in terms of not allowing people with a history of family violence to have firearms licenses, and then generally, you know, cancelling their licenses and removing the firearms if there are family violence incidents. But the system isn't perfect. Certainly, you know, if there is a dispute over whether or not family violence has occurred, in those cases, sometimes police have to give back the firearms, and there certainly are people out there where there are allegations of family violence who do have access to firearms violence. And we also see, unfortunately, with the actual deaths from family violence, we see a very distinct pattern around the use of firearms. So we know that the research has been done on the, you know, kind of which communities family violence is most common, and you kind of see that in the stats. But then when you look at the deaths, there's a big difference between the women who've died from firearms with family violence and the ones who are killed in other ways. When the ones killed with firearms, the demographics are just what does the licensed population look like. So it's just older Pākehā men. Mm. Whereas for the most part, other deaths from intimate partner violence, they're generally younger men, generally not as sort of lower socioeconomic groups, and more likely, unfortunately, than the average to be Māori or Pacifica. But the pattern is completely different with firearms. Mm. And there's certainly the presence of firearms in the home changes the dynamic of the intimate partner violence. The threats are obviously quite different in nature. I remember once talking to a professional woman who had left a relationship, and the partner had a firearms license. He, you know, was a sort of middle class public servant, didn't have any of the sort of like red flags that you might have thought would be there, but she would just find bullets lined up by the washing machine while they were sort of going through their relationship dispute towards the end of the relationship. It was just this very kind of subtle threat because, you know, she knew what was in the firearms safe, and it was really quite awful. And also, you know, firearms are very lethal. So the minute a firearm comes out in a threat situation, like if it's fired, there's a very high risk of, you know, of somebody actually dying. And which is why we see, you know, such different demographics of the women who die by firearms. And certainly if you talk to the people who, you know, like Family Violence Death Review Committee, the stories always involve lots of warning signs. Different agencies have different pieces of information that are not being put together. And yes, you know, if I had my way, we'd probably be much stricter about removing firearms, even when there's a threat of, or, you know, even a suspicion or a hint of family violence. And, you know, yes, that does mean that there's a risk of false allegations, which is always the argument that's made. But I would rather, you know, take that risk and have some people, you know, deprived of their firearms for no good reason than having the risk the other way, because the consequences are so dramatically different.
Yeah, especially, you know, we know that women who are in a violent situation, the risk is at highest when they're trying to leave. So you can only imagine that a firearm in that situation is going to exasperate it even more. I would also be interested to know, and I don't know that you would know this, but even how many women are more likely to stay in a violent or dangerous situation because of that threat of a firearm.
I think it's that. I don't know, and I'm not sure if there's good good data on
so
that.
So hard to know.
You know, sort of in theory, the vetting system is supposed to pick up those things. If, you know, the partner, who's generally a woman, is interviewed separately, try and minimize the risk of intimidation. But, you know, it's certainly very difficult to know, you know, if it is difficult to report family violence, you know, for the person to, you know, talk to people outside about what's going on. And, you know, women are often covering it, you know, sort of not willing to share what's going on because of the risks. And, yeah, so it is hard to screen for those mm-hmm. things and hard to do it well. We don't really know to what extent women are staying in the relationships because mm-hmm. of that kind of threat and risk.
It's such a difficult topic. There's just so many facets to it. I think that's the really interesting thing with gun control, and even from the lobbyist side, it just feeds into so many different areas I think people often don't consider. We did say up top that you are incredibly accomplished. So it's not just gun control that you work on. You also recently released a paper, Shine on the Light, Improving Transparency in New Zealand's Political and Governance Systems. And as part of this, you put forward 26 recommendations to fix the current political system. Can you tell us a little bit about the recommendations?
Sure. And one element of the report was quite interesting. So we covered five different topics, but a big one was political lobbying, which is almost unregulated in New Zealand. And I do have some experience of lobbying myself. So, you know, I've been doing the gun control advocacy for a while now. But the thing that always struck me was, you know, sort of New Zealand politicians talk about, oh, it's very easy to, you know, access politicians and talk to a minister and what have you. And it sort of is generally easy to get in sort of at least once, you know, almost. Well, I think anyone can go talk to their local MP, but your local MP might not be particularly influential. If you're involved with an organisation, you'll probably get one meeting with a relevant minister. But I think the thing that struck me was the kinds of access that the professional lobbyists would have, and they'd be sort of texting ministers and telling them kind of what they wanted and needed, and then they'd sort of be, you know, messaging the office, telling the minister's office, telling them what they wanted, and, you know, and then suddenly the changes get made, whether or not that's because of their influence is hard to say. And we've been seeing that revolving door of politicians leaving the beehive and then kind of a week later back lobbying them on behalf of paying clients. So, the OECD has recognised how badly lobbying is regulated. So we made some recommendations there to line up actually with the Irish example, where we want to see tightening up of that revolving door, a register of lobbyists, and a register that covers their lobbying activity, so you can actually see who's lobbying, and a code of conduct for lobbyists. So lobbying was kind of probably the biggest focus. We also think there should be changes to the way that political parties are funded, because it's far too easy for commercial interests and particularly foreign interests to donate into the system and potentially corrupt things. And you know, we certainly, the reason there's so little money in New Zealand politics is not because you can't do it. In fact, our laws are weaker than, say, the American laws, but it's more that there's sort of less incentive and it's less worthwhile to put a lot of money in. But certainly if you were a foreign state who wanted to interfere in our elections for some reason, would actually be incredibly easy compared to most countries to funnel money in through sort of third parties, and you could set up New Zealand-based companies and donate through those. There are a lot of weaknesses in our system, so we made some recommendations about those. We always want to see some improvements to the Official Information Act. This is the legislation that allows any citizen in the country to get information from the government on what it's doing. It's much abused by politicians who try and make sure as little information as possible goes out. And there were sort of two more technical areas about beneficial ownership. We want to see that opened up. And I am blanking on the fifth one, so we'll move on.
How was it received generally?
It was received remarkably well, actually. So it's very, you know, I did a whole lot of media around it, and even sort of traditionally more conservative media outlets were very supportive of it. The commentators were all in favour. I think it's one of those things where there's actually a very strong consensus out amongst non-politicians for change, but yeah. The problem is that it's the 120 odd MPs who actually need to drive change on this at the end of the day, and they have quite strong interests in not doing anything.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you anticipate seeing any of the recommendations being taken up in either the short or long term?
I mean, we also did a round of lobbying about the lobbying report and spoke to representatives from most of the political parties in Parliament. And there were certainly elements that they were all in favour, or different elements for different parties that they were in favour of. I think that probably, though, at the end, you know, the current government sort of said, yes, these things are important, but it's not a high priority for us. I think at the end of the day, though, there'll probably have to be some other kind of crisis or scandal before something happens. So if we look at Ireland, there was the fallout from the global financial crisis and the incredibly cozy relationships between the banks and the Irish government.
A lot of brown envelopes were passed around in Ireland.
And just the kind of level of public outrage was such that they just couldn't not reform. So I think, unfortunately, we'll take some sort of crisis or serious scandal for there to be reform, and it will probably happen quite quickly when it does.
But then it's almost like circles right back to what we were saying at the start with the impact of the Christchurch attacks, is that then you're probably going to end up with opposition saying, oh, we're just being reactive and it's the minority, and it's just, we end up in that frustrating cycle of something awful has to happen and even that horrific thing is not bad enough.
Yeah, and I mean, this is kind of the problem, particularly in New Zealand, and the reason we don't change these things is because of complacency, and it is the crisis that shows the system is broken. Mm. So, you know, on the kind of corruption and transparency front, New Zealand is steadily sliding down the global transparency rankings, and we used to always be first or second with quite a high score, and we've been sliding down, and we're now down at fourth, and the trajectory is only downward for us. There are certainly some other countries that are coming up who are making quite deliberate efforts to sort of clean up and be more transparent and less corrupt, but if we sit and do nothing, we're only going to keep sliding down, and it does have quite big effects. It's not, and New Zealand is not so much a kind of cash envelope kind of corruption. It's more sort of trading of political favours. You know, I'll fund your political campaign if you pass laws.
I'll
that
scratch
favor my
your back if you scratch mine.
If you pass laws that favour my business, is kind of more of what happens here. And, it does end up distorting the economy. So, you know, we're investing, you know, the money starts flowing to the businesses that are good at lobbying the government around the businesses that are productive. And the OECD and their economic reviews of New Zealand has been warning about these risks, that we end up with a very tilted playing field. And, you know, there's strong, they see big risks to the economy from not addressing these issues.
So it's a public report.
Yes.
So where can we find it if we want to read
it? It's on the Helen Clark Foundation website. I can't remember the URL off the top of my head, but I'm sure you can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Philippa, honestly, you must never sleep. And I mean, until recently, you were even on the board of the Holocaust Centre. Can you tell us a little bit about the Holocaust Centre and your involvement?
Yeah, so my grandmother was a German Jew, so she grew up in a small village in Germany near Frankfurt, and her family had lived in that village and the surrounding villages for generations. I've traced the family back, goes at least the first note. Named ancestor I could find was back in the 1600s, so long time there. because they were in Germany, obviously, with Hitler's rise to power, the sort of persecution of the Jews actually started in the small towns first before it moved to the cities. And, you know, it was all through the 1930s, and the actual death camps came much later. So my grandmother and her parents and siblings and grandparents certainly suffered persecution in that village. And they ended up fleeing first to Frankfurt on Main and then to South Africa. I recently went through the process of regaining German citizenship. So did a whole lot of research on the family and learnt more about her story and got quite interested in that and joined the Holocaust Centre. So the Holocaust Centre has a group for second and third generation survivors. Mostly where we kind of meet up every now and again and talk about how tortured our parents and grandparents were and why didn't anyone ever talk about any of this stuff. Because there is that sort of intergenerational element to trauma. And I sort of got reasonably involved and joined the board, and that would have probably been in about the middle of 2023. Holocaust Centre has a strong focus on Holocaust education, ensuring that people in New Zealand understand the Holocaust. They certainly have to respond to various kinds of anti-Semitism that happen in the community, and they're very much focused on the Holocaust, and for the longest time had avoided really talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict. And then the 7th of October attacks happened, and the newish chair had decided that we should be adopting a definition of anti-Semitism that equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, which I don't really support. And they were producing a lot of statements that sort of emphasized Israeli trauma without acknowledging the trauma and suffering of Palestinians. And I wasn't very comfortable with that. I argued for a return to the more neutral policy of kind of trying to keep out of the conflict and not take sides in it, because in my view, you know, the whole sort of never again thing, it's got to be for everyone. It can't just be, well, you know, I'm a universalist. I don't think that, you know, some people should have more human rights than others. And just because Jews have suffered from anti-Semitism doesn't mean that other people haven't suffered from other kinds of hatred. And it doesn't immunize Jewish people from themselves being perpetrators of various kinds of hatred. My grandmother, despite growing up in a, you know, horrible, horrible kind of divided society where they were right at the bottom, they moved to South Africa and she was quite comfortable with being on top of the racial hierarchy there, didn't particularly have a problem with apartheid, you know. So it's very easy to go from being oppressed to being an oppressor. And, so we had a difference of view, and so I resigned from the Holocaust Centre because I just wasn't comfortable with the general direction that was being taken.
Oh, Philip, I'm sorry to hear that. Are you, if in general, I mean, what is the work of the Holocaust Centre? Can somebody just go down and visit?
Or? Yeah, so I'm still a member, and I'm certainly support some of the work that they do. The centre's here in Wellington, and anyone can visit. They have quite a lot of materials about particularly Jewish survivors of the Holocaust who moved to Wellington and their stories. There's some quite fascinating stories, there were not large numbers because New Zealand had very, very restrictive immigration laws at the time, but certainly a sort of small trickle of refugees who ended up in New Zealand from Europe, and talks about some of their stories. They've got quite a lot of information panels. There's a quite a large library with materials on the Holocaust. So if you're particularly interested in the topic, you can absolutely go there. They also run a school program and teach children about what happened during the Holocaust as well. And generally, if they can, they'll line up some survivors or descendants of survivors. It's mostly descendants these days because there are very few survivors who are still alive at this point. But yeah, so if you're interested in the topic, it's certainly a place with some good resources and connections to the Aotearoa story. And you know, they've also done some projects like translated the diary of Anne Frank into Māori, so it's available in Te Reo Māori for anyone who's interested.
I didn't know that.
I've done a tour of the Holocaust Centre, and it was very interesting to see, as you say, it's small, but that New Zealand nexus, and it was interesting to see it put in that local perspective here. I think it was quite interesting, I guess, for a lot of people. You know, growing up in Ireland, you're a lot closer and you get a lot more of the history from Europe, and I imagine you find that the same, Sophie. But I think here it probably helped humanise it and made it hit home a little bit more than it probably seems like quite a remote thing all the way down here in New Zealand. So that was interesting. But I'm sorry to hear that difference, but it's always tricky when you see, you know, when you're involved in something that you can recognise the good but you don't agree with parts of it. It's really difficult, but also good on you for standing up for your beliefs and sticking with your guns, because that can also be really hard, sticking with your guns. Oh man, no pun was intended there. Didn't even realize.
So good.
So it was an unintentional pun. But yeah, because it's not easy to step away from something that you had been really involved in, and especially something as high profile as that. So I really admire that. But Philippa, honestly, don't know when you sleep. You're incredible. You're doing so many things between all your work in the gun control. I think that's going to become more and more important, unfortunately, as we go forward and we continue to see that rise of that kind of far right rhetoric. I think your work is going to become even more important. So thank you so much for that. And also your work in transparency. I think there's a lot more we can do in that space. So I'm really hoping we start to see some positive changes in New Zealand as a result of your paper.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to positive changes.
Yeah. And obviously, because you're such an incredible wahine toa, where can listeners find out more about you and some of the things that you're involved in?
I don't actually have social media, which smart. You can easily follow me on. So unfortunately, I can't give you any of my social media handles. But you can certainly follow along with Gun Control NZ. We're at Gun Control NZ on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, very modern. Honestly, let's check you out with the new social media apps.
And we're also on LinkedIn too. So I think we're on 5 platforms, which is a nightmare to manage. And then there's also a website, guncontrol.nz. If you want to find out more about the transparency stuff, if you go on the Helen Clark Foundation, you can download the report. And the Holocaust Centre also has a website, but again, I can't remember the URL off the top of my head if you want to find out more about their work.
Thank you so much, Philippa. It's been lovely to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks, New Zealand On Air, for funding accessmedia.nz.